In the years following World War II, the Russian occupation of Hungary was having a tumultuous impact on the country's government and economy. Hungarian society was changing, and jobs were scarce. In this environment, a young man found himself in search of employment.
I remember I was getting to the point where I was literally afraid of going hungry. In the most literal sense of the word, I had an encounter. I was looking for a job without very much hope, any job, and found myself confronted by a newly powerful person, who was a communist, who had the power of patronage, could have given me a job or not given me a job. And there he was, a sort of a powerful, fleshy, muscular man in a beautiful, beautifully cut gabardine suit, heavy silk shirt. And there I was, sort of skinnier, miserable person, trembling. And he said to me after a brief conversation, he said to me, you and your kind will never get a job in this country. And that marked me.
The young man was Anthony Dejasay, and within a few years he fled Hungary to Australia, where he earned an economics degree at the University of Western Australia.
And such economics says, as I've ever learned, I really learned there. I learned Alfred Marshall there. Because the only thing I attended was, because I was working, the only thing I attended, there was an evening seminar once a week on Marshall. And that was excellent, first class. There were only three or four of us.
So with a Marshallian neoclassical background, Anthony Dejasay was recommended for study at Oxford and found himself continuing his education at the very center for Keynesian thought. He eventually left Oxford after having his fill of academic pursuits and settled in Paris, where he pursued a career in finance, retiring in 1979. In retirement, he found himself interested in an analysis of the relationship between government and individuals. And in 1985, his work, The State, was published, an analysis of modern political arrangements that views the state as acting primarily in its own interests and often in opposition to the interests of both society and individuals. The State garnered interest for Dejasay's unique point of view and was followed by Social Contract, Free Ride, a study of the public goods problem in 1989. Choice, Contract, Consent, a restatement of liberalism in 1991, before resorting to Politics in 1996 and Against Politics in 1997. Altogether, his work has become noteworthy for its brilliant, individualistic, and unconventional analysis of power, politics, and freedom. His arguments call for a new view of the role and scope of government action and state intervention, and a clear understanding of and focus on the importance of individual liberty.
Well, Tony, as far as I understand your career, you were for a while in Oxford and you were really on your way to stay in Oxford, at least in a sense, but eventually this didn't work out.
Yes, I had this run-in. Yeah, I was recommended. I got into correspondence from Australia with Dennis Robertson, D.H. Robertson. Mm-hmm. Who was at Cambridge, as you may know, and who was not a Keynesian at all. very far from it. And he strongly recommended me to certain people in Oxford, very kindly. And I was given Roy Harrod as a supervisor. And my project, which was very hazy, involved, among other things, a critique of things like liquidity preference and really the whole macro methodology which characterizes Keynes. And of course, Roy Harrod, who was deeply loyal to Keynes, for whom Keynes was God, resented this enormously. And he didn't like foreigners anyway. Plus, I had the arrogance to attack his God. And we didn't get on at all. It was a very difficult period. He was very courteous. And finally, it was arranged that I should be supervised by John Hicks, who, as you may remember, later got the Nobel.
And you greatly admired John Hicks, didn't
I
you?
I greatly admired John Hicks, yes, yes.
Was
I think he was tremendous brain, tremendous brain.
Was your criticism of Keynes somehow inspired by reading other people's work? Or evidently, I guess you did not have any knowledge, say, of von Hayek at that time, I guess.
No.
What motivated your criticism?
I think what motivated
Keynes?
Me was that I felt unhappy about all these things just moving around on the map for, I mean, the consumption function standing there and the marginal efficiency of capital looming large and liquidity preference. These were words and maybe statistical magnitudes, but I didn't feel them connected to any human motivation. Mm-hmm. I think the long and short of it is that I didn't believe in any macroeconomics that didn't start off with micro.
Yes, so you were far ahead of your time, because later on people would talk about the micro foundations of macroeconomics very intensely.
Yes, but that came much, much later.
Much later, yes.
We are not talking of 1955.
Yes.
And when I started in Oxford.
Yes, and those were the heydays of Keynesianism.
Yes, yes.
And then you became, well, what would we call it? A practitioner of economics or a businessman?
I think it has very little to do with economics. It has a lot to do with common sense and alertness of mind. I mean, finance has very little to do with economics. That's an error. I think what economics does for you is it teaches you to think. Mm-hmm. But its subject matter is of very little importance. Anyway, I did this transformation, this change of skin, quite rapidly, from 62 onwards. I left Oxford in 62, after 7 years, and stayed in Paris, being mainly a sort of financial person, until 1979. When I sort of formally retired.
What was it that after such a long period of time brought you back to something which might be called philosophy and economics rather than economics only?
Yes, it's not terribly easy to explain because it really happened in two phases. The first phase was a state of excitement that I have to write a book about the state, which I did. And that was a very strong impulse.
Why was this impulse so strong? Due to some experiences in your past, or what really triggered it?
Yes, I think it was due to an accumulation of all my experiences. But perhaps the two focal points was the first, what I have already mentioned earlier, my encounter with this man, who to me represented the state, this big, fat, beautiful, muscular communist, who said, "You and your kind must perish." And I reflected on that, and that I found very interesting. Even after I escaped from this cleft stick of living in a communist country, I found this very interesting, because what it meant to me is that the state can starve you if it has sufficient power over jobs, over the economy, because it can decide that you will not get a job. Because all jobs depend directly or indirectly from the state. If there is enough nationalization, if there is enough state influence over the economy, if there are not, as Schumpeter put it, great private fortresses in the economy to which you can flee from the state. When all these private fortresses are demolished, then you are utterly delivered to the state. And that, that is something that has marked me and that kept sort of working under my own skin. And the second thing that, which really set me off was, I find this very difficult to explain even to myself. You may remember the early 1980s. There was a very revolutionary situation in Poland, with the Solidarity Movement and etc. And it got so that you could really realistically say that 99.9% of the population, including party members, were against the regime and would gladly overthrow it if they could. And they couldn't. And the way I put it was, the army occupied its own country. That is, the Polish army occupied Poland and kept the lid on things. Now, of course, it's very easy to say, well, this wouldn't have worked, couldn't have worked, if it hadn't been for the Russian army over the border, mm-hmm. who was, I mean, which was a sort of last resort for these people. But still, it was a structure which I found fascinating, that everybody is against a regime and the regime maintains itself. And then I said, well, I must write this down and must work it out. And that's how I wrote The State.
I thought that one of the major predictions of your book is that a limited government, or really minimal state or something like this, just would be an anomaly.
Yes.
And that comes out of your analysis of the model. Could you perhaps expand a bit on this?
Yes. Well, I think there are two ways of undermining the thesis that limited government is possible. And one is the way I have chosen in The State, and the other that I have applied later on in another essay that has been republished. And the approach I used in The State, which I think has its own logic, although it sounds outlandish, is this. If you have somebody who sits on top of a society, why does he do so? What is his purpose in life? He wants to maximize his power to do things that he wants to do, which may be his power to do good, or his power to change the face of the earth, or his power to make people happy, or favor one part of society over another. Anything you care to think of, all this takes what I call discretionary power. That is, power over and above the power you need to stay in power. Mm-hmm. In any case, it is plain that you want this power to use it for something. Limited government is renouncing something that you could do. I mean, if you say, I could do good, but I have tied my own hands, i.e., I adopted limited government or a minimal state, therefore I shall not do good. This is absurd. Of course you will do good. And you will not accept to shackle your own hands.
But this presupposes that you really have a kind of unitary actor. Say there would be many people in this group and who were not sure that they would stay in power forever. You see, you have a group of 200 and 100 of them are not so sure or so certain that they will be in the leading group forever or something like this.
No.
Wouldn't that be a problem for a position like yours?
Well, it could be. It could be. It could be. Governing idea is that people intend to stay in power. They may fail. Mm-hmm. It's like my governing idea is people marry to stay married, not in order to get divorced.
Yes. But some of them might...
Although often this is the outcome.
Yes. But some of them might anticipate that and have a contingency plan for the case of failure.
You're absolutely right. And that's why perhaps my theory is a simplistic one, but it's more powerful for that, like all simple theories.
Yes, I agree that this is an interesting theory that sheds a lot of light on many phenomena. Still, you are a methodological individualist. And
I hope so.
And you build up a theory in which there is a unitary actor. Isn't there a certain tension? Because this group
yes.
acts not as individuals, but as a unitary
Well,
actor.
The group acts as individuals who recognize where their best interest lies. Who are maximizers in terms of collective rationality. It's like people who, in a conflictual game, choose cooperation.
This is a typical attitude, I think, of an economist, isn't it? Let's assume that so-and-so is the case.
Yes, then see what happens.
What happens.
Yes, yes.
Let's stay a bit with the state and its career as a book. That must have brought you into contact with people you weren't in contact with before. Or how did that work out? Did you get into contact, say, with the Montpellier Society due to this book, or how did that all work
yes,
out?
Yes, I think so. You must remember that I was sitting in the country, in a not even a village, in a very, very small place, and had no contact, systematic or otherwise, with the academic world. And there was no reason why anybody should pay any attention to this book, except the principal shaker and doer who caused it to be remarked was Jim Buchanan. There were two or three other people, but less influential, I think, than he. And Jim Buchanan, had me invited by the Mont Pelerin Society, and I became a member. I was very pleased. And B, invited me to a seminar in America where I met a few academics. And I suppose such little recognition as I have in the academic world is due to these introductions by Jim Buchanan, to whom I owe a great debt.
but whom you always criticized, as I did all the time, for his contractarianism.
Yes.
What would be your principal criticism of contractarianism?
I think what my criticism boils down to is this. The need for contractarianism as the bedrock on which you build a society, as an orderly society, arises out of the assumption that contracts among individuals, bilateral contracts between you and me, are not enforceable unless there is an enforcer. Because if contracts could be concluded and relied upon without such a central enforcer, then we would be sitting pretty and we wouldn't need the state, because everything could be resolved by contracting. So, to create the enforcer, we need this social contract. But if we are capable of concluding a social contract and create the enforcer, then we don't need it. We are either capable of concluding a contract or not. I mean, it's like saying, here is a man. He can't jump over his own shadow. It's impossible. This is the equivalent of saying contracts are not enforceable unless there is an enforcer. So having said that there is this man who can't jump over his own shadow, you then turn around and say, now see, he's jumped over his own shadow and created a social contract. To me, this is unacceptable. Or another way of saying it is, suppose an enforcer is created, he must enforce fairness, which is one of the terms of the contract. But it's not in his interest that fairness should prevail. His interest is that he and his coalition partners, i.e. the winning side of society, should be able to exploit the losing side of society. That is his direct interest. So how can we suppose, we as contractarians, that the enforcer will enforce the conditions of the contract against himself? This again is a self-contradictory assumption, which it is very, very difficult to get out of.
Contractarians used to argue that the initial contract or the fiction of an initial contract is useful, but you seem to assume that it is really dangerous to make this assumption or to engage in such a fiction and think that this is the right way to think about government.
What I am trying to say is this. There is a logic trap, i.e. that you need the state because you are unable to conclude binding agreements without it. This is the enforcement problem. And the logic trap lies in the supposition that you can conclude an agreement to create the state after having said that the reason for the state is that you can't conclude agreements. So, how do we justify a topsy-turvy, self-contradictory theory like this? My proposition is that, of course, we can't justify it, but it has its usefulness for those who want to legitimize the state. Because if people buy this line, that what they are really doing is voluntarily accepting the state, then of course it's very much more easy for the state to rule over them because they assume that it's legitimate, that they have themselves created and accepted it. And that is why I think that contractarianism is a very dangerous doctrine. Not only is it false, logically untenable, but it also acts as an opium of the people.
So you say in other places that the state is a means of exploiting other people without violence or without having taking resort to violence.
Yes.
And if I understand correctly what you are saying, well, contractarianism is a kind of grease in this exploitation process. It facilitates it,
yes,
even. And so it's dangerous for this very reason.
It disarms people's suspicion.
So
we are doing this to ourselves. We've agreed to do it.
So we are disarmed, we are not really suspicious of the government, which is always illegitimate.
Yes. I think that's the point I'm trying to make.
So what would be the legitimate role of the political philosopher?
I think it's his duty to, if he sees it the way I see it, and of course not very many political philosophers do see it my way, but if he sees it the way I see it, I think he should stand up and scream, as I have stood up and screamed. And that really leads me to something I have said earlier, when you asked, well, how did I come back to an intellectual career? And I said, this is really two stages. And the first stage is, I felt an impulse to write The State. And then the follow-up to that is that later on I felt an impulse to scream because there were so many false ideas floating about, which I thought it was my job to try and shoot down.
You said you were observing Poland in the early 80s, and you were observing that there almost everybody was against government. But government still subsisted. On the other hand, you were living in France at that time. You just were not living in Poland. Wouldn't you say that this kind of government was a better government than the Polish one? And isn't it then worth our efforts to go for the better government, or say the one which is not as bad as the other one?
This type of government, of course, is very much better for the people who live under it than the absurdity that was Poland in the 1980s. But that doesn't mean that we should welcome it or approve it, precisely because it is more tolerable. Therefore, it's more likely to survive and more likely to corrupt us. Nobody will get seduced by the type of government that the Poles had in the 1980s. Proof, they always tried to rebel against it. But most people are prepared to abide by this lukewarm, redistributionist soft-left regime that is typified by France in the last 70 or 80 years.
But don't you fear that criticism of this kind of government might undermine its foundations, not only to improve it for the better, but rather to go all the way towards Poland or something like this? Some people might object to a position like yours.
Yes.
Okay, we don't like this type of government, but we are really afraid that if we change it fundamentally, we might go towards Polish conditions.
Look, I don't really believe that I have the influence, even if I write 10 more books, that I have the influence to endanger the foundations of social democratic government in Western Europe or, or elsewhere. I am not that effective a subversive person. What I do want to do is make it a little more difficult for this type of government to get away with it and to persuade people to look at these things with a little clearer understanding than they do at present, and perhaps in this way obtain a tiny, tiny marginal adjustment that wouldn't have taken place if certain issues hadn't been clarified.
Do we have some trust in, say, basic attitudes or values as limiting government, as you expressed just before in your remarks? But you don't seem to have any trust in constitutional limits to government.
The way things are, there is an absolutely unjustified, totally excessive faith in constitutions, which is due partly to this American legend that the relative success of America is due to its constitution, whereas I think it's pretty well irrelevant. Things happened because they happened independently of what the founders, what the constitution said and how it was amended, etc. I think this is effect rather than cause. This excessive faith, partly because of the influence of the American example and the American faith in its own constitution, and partly because political scientists have always taken constitutions, as the French would say, à la lettre. They had this deep belief in the written word, whereas I don't. And I tried in various ways to demonstrate why constitutions are irrelevant. Now, when I said that, or when I say it now, I confess I am overstating the case, but I'm overstating it deliberately, because it has been overstated the other way. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to redress the balance. Bearing this in mind, I will say this. Show me a constitution ever that has limited the ability of government to take whatever share of the national income the voters authorize it to take by way of taxes. Show me a constitution that effectively limits the ability of the state to preempt resources.
It's a bit surprising to me, because I already thought, reading the historical evidence, it took a long time before, here in the US, for instance, big government took off.
It isn't the Constitution that prevented the federal government from increasing the tax load. No, just political preconditions weren't there. The balance of power wasn't there. I will say this. America is an unbelievably lucky society. Because they inherited the earth, they inherited a continent. They had the frontier at any rate, they had the frontier till the last third of the 19th century, even beyond it. And once you have, when you have the frontier, then you don't have the same redistributive forces at work. Mm-hmm. Then, when the thing is already closed, and this is really the difference between the positive sum and the zero sum. Redistribution is far more attractive and interesting and inevitable when you have a zero-sum situation. America wasn't in that situation for 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 a very, very, very long time. Unbelievable luck. Second unbelievable luck is the origin of its immigrants. I mean, the origin of the culture of its settlers. All this has made for a marvelous start, whose achievements are now, of course, being gradually eroded. And if you cast your mind ahead 100 years, I don't know what you see, but I see pretty well the same kind of mild social democratic regime as I see in Europe. But I may be quite wrong.
Mentioning the American frontier, one could presumably describe conditions in America as special also in one other respect. People, so to say, could emigrate into anarchy. Wasn't that true at that time?
Yes, that's part of the effect of the frontier.
Now, some people might say that you are a kind of anarchist. Would you describe yourself as an anarchist or a reluctant anarchist?
No, I don't mind. If I were the only anarchist, I would be very happy to wear the title. What embarrasses me about it is that the few other anarchists, many of them are crazy. And I don't feel like I'm being identified with them. So that embarrasses me. But I mean, if I have to tell you the truth, yes, I am an anarchist.
But is it really?
That doesn't mean that I believe that anarchy here and now is possible. It's desirable, but not possible.
Would that be a conceivable possibility at all in a world where somebody might invent the state anyway and use it as a predatory instrument? Don't we need some kind of state then to defend us against this kind of aggression?
Well, you may be right, but of course then is the remedy not worse than the disease? I mean, it's rather like saying let's infect ourselves with some terrible infectious disease, because otherwise we might get it.
Well, but if there is a difference between a state like Poland and a state like France, even though you don't like either of them, wouldn't it be still worthwhile to go for the one against the other?
From a short-term perspective, yes. From a long-term perspective, I'm not sure.
Tony, you always have insisted that government has an intrinsic proclivity to grow. And you also pointed out that democratic governments will tend to grow very strongly because they have all these redistributive concerns involved. Wouldn't you say that? Would
yes.
you claim this?
Yes, I think the idea is that when you have collective choice and individual choice side by side, it is within the power of collective choice to preempt individual choice, but never vice versa. I mean, a collectivity can always decide to include within its competence something that has been individual until then, such as, I mean, to give you a very mundane example, collectivity can always decide that instead of leaving you half of your income to be spent as you wish, it'll only leave 45% of your income to spend as you wish and take, preempt 55. This is always within the realm of, within the power of collective choice. Now, the question then is, can you limit this power? This is the problem of limited government. there is this intrinsic capacity of collective choice to eat up the scope for individual choice. And how do you limit this appetite? And of course, I mean, if I believed that it is a matter of will, a matter of wish, or a matter of conviction to limit government, like I suppose Jim Buchanan believes, then I would not be an anarchist, because I would say, well, this is a marvelous, lovely compromise. We'll have a bit of government, but not too much. Yes. Fortunately, I'm led to the conviction that this is wishful thinking. And the reason why I believe this is because if you have any democratic choice rule, you have anonymous voices, and the decision is taken by voice count. Everybody counts for one and nobody for more than one. Now, within the group that is competent to make this collective choice, like an electorate, the rule, whatever the rule is, the rule provides for a blocking minority, which can prevent a decision. Under majority rule, this is 50% and one vote, the 50% and the tiebreaker. But of course, you could have a supermajority rule where the blocking minority is much, much smaller. But no matter how small, provided it's not one person, i.e., which means veto right, which in my language is not collective choice. No matter how small your blocking minority, no matter how careful and cautious and rigorous your supermajority rule, so as to protect society from the tyranny of, so-called tyranny of the majority, there's always a way to split that blocking minority. I mean, if it takes two people to block a decision, only two people, everybody else may be of one mind, but there are two people who don't want it. Those who do want it can always bribe the poorer of the two with the money of the richer and say, do come in with us and let's exploit this rich man. This is potentially always a maximizing strategy.
But this
that's why I believe that in this valley of tears, there is no limited government.
Perhaps we should talk a bit about a realm in which presumably you don't clash with Buchanan, because I think he didn't say too much about it. But I think some of your most interesting remarks are concerning private contract enforcement. And I think it's very interesting that you have this view that a market, so to say, could work without being created by the legal order as a centrally enforced legal order, even a large market.
Yes.
And I must say, I always have been in error on this point formally, and you convinced me I'm wrong on this, because you said it's just something that can be done by individuals themselves. They can find mechanisms of contract enforcement. But it's implausible, presumably, to many people. There are two people dealing with each other. You have oranges, I have apples. You want my apples rather than your oranges. I would rather have your oranges than my apples. I have to give my apples first. Let's assume this.
Mm-hmm.
What protection do I have that you don't take the apples and the oranges
and not deliver the oranges?
So,
yes. Well, of course, you very correctly formulated the case, which is the interesting case where the two performances, the two sides of the contract, are not simultaneous. Because what is often forgotten when people say, contract is hopeless, without a central enforcer. What people forget is that the vast bulk of economic transactions consist of simultaneous or nearly simultaneous performances, which are cash transactions, so to speak, which are self-enforcing. But then let's forget about those because they don't present the problem. The problem comes with the type of contact you mentioned, where I have your apples and you haven't yet got my oranges, and then I say, bye bye, no oranges. So what happens? Of course, there are two things here. One is my own self-interest. If I really cheat and don't deliver the oranges, because I am a dead man as far as you are concerned, I can never cheat you a second time.
But you could find another fool.
I have to search for another fool, and then the word spreads. The world is always a small place. This is where I differ very sharply from Hayek. I think Hayek has done great harm to social theory by making us believe that the world was a vast place and it was all anonymous. There's very little in the world that is anonymous. Everything gets known. This thing which I have seen over and over and over again, nothing remains secret. I cheated you. Now I have to go out and seek for another fool, and very soon I will find that they've all heard of me, and I will just be unable to deal, cheat or not cheat. Even if I am fully, if I am a repentant sinner and want to perform, very many people will just say, thank you, go somewhere else. So that's the one. The first constraint that disciplines me. And the second one, which is perhaps not quite as obvious and quite as strong, but I think it does work in communities which don't rely on state enforcement, and that's mutual help. Because if there are several of us, and especially if we are all of one trade or one industry or perhaps one locality, but this is particularly strong across industries. If you cheat, it's in everybody's interest in this industry to expend some effort or some cost, not an inordinately large cost, to discipline you, in order to maintain discipline in the industry. And there'll be an element of mutual help in contact enforcement. There's always more to be gained in total by performing contracts than by defaulting on them. Well, so that is the second element where I think mutual aid would work in favor of contract fulfillment. And of course, this is borne out to some extent by game theory, where if the effect on the future of your present action is really significant, then it's almost never, or hardly ever, the dominant strategy to cheat. I.e., that it's always best, or nearly always best, to allow your contract to be enforced or simply to fulfill it.
But game theory also shows, some of the evolutionary game theory studies at least do this, that in games like the one we described, exchange of apples and oranges and things like this, those who are cheaters in the role of the second mover who has to fulfill. You were the one who had to give the oranges after you received the apples. That those who are, let me put it a bit bluntly, born cheaters might survive, not all of them. There may be a small evolutionary niche, so to say, for those.
A residual
mm-hmm. of those who just could get away with it, because it wouldn't pay to monitor them if they are a very mm-hmm. small minority. Mm-hmm. So some people might say, oh, that's a reason to drive even them out, to get government in, because what you described up to now is enforcement of contracts without government.
Yes.
And what's your response to this, that there's maybe some people who say, oh, but it's outrageous that these cheaters get away?
I think my response is that we are not in pursuit of perfection. That we want real societies, not abstract ideals, where there's no cheating. Obviously, when you have government enforcement, you have a vast array of cheating and abuse of the government enforcement, which is then turned to your advantage. That's not an ideal society either.
Yes. So it's really comparative advantages of the two that you...
Yes, but I think the balance of advantages is incomparable in favor of spontaneous enforcement, rather than because we have seen how government enforcement ends up.
We were talking about the state as crowding out the ability of individuals to enforce their contracts themselves. Now the state seems to crowd out a lot of other abilities of individuals to care for themselves. If you look at the history of public insurance and the growth of the welfare state, I think there's a lot of material or historical evidence that could support the view that the state moved in unnecessarily.
I have no view on whether there is a kind of risk that we need insurance against, which is not insurable, other than by society as a whole, by the state. I don't immediately see such risks, but perhaps there are some. They can't be very prevalent. But I grant you, maybe, I have no view on it, maybe there are such things, but let's deal with the risks that are insurable. Let's deal with things other than risk. We've dealt with contract, but there are many, many other things that we have the state do for us. And it's somewhat tacitly assumed that it can only be done by the state. Insurance against welfare risks is one of them, it's a very important one. But now increasingly it's very fashionable to talk of transactions costs, which only the state can reduce. All these are very dubious propositions. And I put it to you that the origin of them is that it's always convenient for the person who would otherwise have to either carry this risk or insure this risk at his immediate expense to shove it on. Take the trader who says, but there are transactions costs, and why the hell should I bear them? Let the state bear them. And that brings forth the false theory that only the state can bear them. But all this is just free riding. When I ask for social insurance, please insure me against illness, or please insure me against this, that, and the other, at the public expense, I say this because somehow, foolishly, I imagine that then I am getting a free ride. that somebody else will be paying for it. There's always this instinctive feeling that let George do it, I mean, let the state do it, and then it will not be at my expense. But ultimately, of course, it is at my expense, but that's very difficult to sense and to perceive.
But some of the really very hard-nosed, one could say, liberal thinkers or conservative thinkers, I'm just thinking of, say, Anthony Flew, for instance, they would say, yes, the state has certain responsibilities to care for those who just simply can't pay for themselves or something like this. And I think somebody like you actually must go the whole way and say, even for those, the state should not be the institution that has to care for them. It should be done privately.
Yes, I think that is my view. My feeling is that maybe now it's too late. Maybe society is spoiled. But my view is that if there's no state provision to begin with, then you get spontaneous reactions in society. And people come forward, certain people, not everybody, people come forward and fulfill these functions. They do look after the very poor. The very poor isn't abandoned, not anymore than by state provision. Mm-hmm. State provision is also awful. Everything is awful. I mean, this is the basic truth. To be very poor is awful. To be destitute or infirm or what have you. But let's not imagine that nobody falls through the cracks under state provision. People do fall through the cracks, just as they would fall through the cracks under private provision. But I think private provision is more sensitive, it's more personal, it's infinitely more efficient, because it's very closely adapted to individual cases, which state provision cannot be, because otherwise it would be favoritism. And therefore I say, let the state not do it. Today everybody says, or at least people I talk to say, hell, I'm not going to give. I pay 45% tax. I pay enough tax for the state to do it, which is very bad.
But doesn't that indicate that a society as the one you envision would have to be willing to be very hard on certain
issues? Yes, very harsh, very harsh.
Yes.
And during a transitional period, which may be as long as a generation, it would be awfully difficult. And there are moments when I say, in all honesty, let's just give it up. Let's just call it impossible. Because these things are path dependent, and once you've trodden a certain path, you can't just come back and pretend that nothing has happened in the meantime. You have changed. The society has changed. It has lost lost certain capacities to react in the proper way. It's got corrupted. All this free riding is now in our blood.
Well, you coined the wonderful phrase, I think, the return of the free rider. Could you briefly describe what you meant by this? Because you are talking of free rider.
Yes,
now.
Yes. The way I came to this is all the literature since the prisoner's dilemma came into public view, came into the literature, the justification of the state has become more sophisticated. And it all revolves around the prisoner's dilemma. Because there is a dominant strategy, which is to default, to not to cooperate, and that can only be overcome by coercion, and coercion then is in our own interest, because unaided by coercion, we cannot reach the cooperative, I mean the Pareto superior level. And why is this? Because of the temptation of free riding.
I can just get the benefits without paying for it.
Yeah.
Now comes the return of
the free riding. Now I go on and I say, all right, so what the state does, it forces us to contribute. That is to pay taxes, to put it bluntly and sort of crudely. And the instant we pay taxes, we create the platform for the free rider. I mean, if we are under no compulsion to contribute, and somebody attempts to free ride, of course, he will immediately fall flat on his face because we will withdraw our contribution. We are not going to let him free ride. Whereas if we are logged into what I call the sucker position, where we contribute, 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 regardless, then of course he will free ride, free ride, free ride, regardless. That is, the free rider will come back. He's been supposedly expelled from the system by this wonderful construction, the state. But in fact, whereas we kicked him out of the door, he's come back through the ceiling, through the window, in redoubled force, because there's now an infinite or almost infinite scope for free riding. Because we cannot withdraw our contributions when somebody free rides. So he'll require government services, he'll require welfare entitlements, he will require law enforcement, he will require the smoothing out of transactions costs and God knows what else. And he'll get all these things. So he'll loom enormously large, much, much, much larger than the most pessimistic theory of the prisoner's dilemma has ever imagined. Because in the proper prisoner's dilemma, of course, these outcomes where one person free rides and the other is a sucker are impossible. They just don't happen.
Or if they happen, they just happen once.
But they happen for 30 seconds and the sucker withdraws.
But didn't you say at another place, okay, there may be instances where people are just willing to be suckers to a certain extent permanently.
Yes.
They just willingly assign themselves to this role because they think, well, on average, they may do more good than bad through this.
Yeah. More good for themselves.
For them.
Yes.
Or they just want to help others, and if they are exploited, they just don't
yes,
mind.
Yes, they may also be altruistically. Yes, I agree with that, yes. But there's a tremendous distinction between the mechanism where you are coerced, supposedly for your own good, to contribute and thereby create this feather bed for the free rider, and the other version where you say, I am not compelled to do this, I do it by cool calculation. I believe that it's either in my own interest or it gives me altruistic satisfaction to contribute voluntarily. But these are different mechanisms and different motivations and different theories.
Could you expand a bit on what a liberty is as opposed to a right? But first of all, perhaps we might be interested in what a liberty is.
Well, it's always bad practice to start with the definition because you tie yourself down. But But liberty is the exercise of free will. In the face of incentives and resistances, which you balance and you choose a course of action or just an act. And if this is not illicit, i.e., it is not outlawed by a social convention, then it is a freedom, it's a liberty. It's an act you perform without offending an important convention. Whereas a right is not an act you perform, it's an act which you require somebody else to perform. A right is a right to a performance by somebody. Mm.
But your liberty, your concept of liberty is, of course, as you said, totally dependent on the existing conventions.
Yes.
You could not
yes.
say that in society X, because they have certain conventions which define what the liberties prevalent in this society mm-hmm. are, they are violating something like, say, natural liberty or something like this.
No.
This is impossible in your view. It's just no. totally conventional.
Yes. Yes.
I think that academia can really do no better than focus on your theories as fresh views from the outside, a new perspective. And I'm very grateful that I had the chance to talk to you today. Thank you very much.
Well, I am very grateful both to you and to Liberty Fund to have had the chance of holding forth. And my apologies to the viewer if I have bored him. Thank you.